This is Mass Timber Today, and I'm Ann Coven. This podcast explores the opportunities and challenges of mass timber with experts in the design, building, and forestry sectors to shed light on the question, what is the future of mass timber construction? In this episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Jeremy Williams. Jeremy is a registered professional forester with the province of Ontario in Canada. He is also president of Arbor Vitae Environmental Services, providing clients with services related to carbon offsets, verification, forest management planning, forest economics, auditing, and consulting. Today, we delve into the sourcing aspect of mass timber to help builders and architects understand where their wood is coming from and how to ensure it is coming from a sustainable source. We also touch on biogenic carbon and its implications in sustainable construction, with the climate crisis always in mind. Jeremy, you are well known in the forest sustainability sector for your work as a forest economist and your leadership in innovating forest practices regarding climate change, as well as indigenous forest tenure and management options, among other areas. So why don't you tell our listeners how you became interested in forests and how it became a part of your career?
Sure, Ann. Thank you very much for asking me to join you for a podcast. I've always enjoyed talking with you, and I'm going to enjoy this discussion, I'm sure. I became interested in forests from a very young age, actually. I remember when I was probably 6 or 7, during the height of Dutch elm disease and all the dead elm trees that were around. And I remember staring at them and wanting to cut them all down and make firewood out of them. And my grandparents had a cottage in Muskoka that we went to every summer for quite a long period of time. And I went to summer camps in the north and was a junior ranger when I was 17. And all of that just gave me a really strong love for forests and for being out in the forest. And that's what propelled me into forestry.
Excellent. And I know, Jeremy, you're also a professional forester and a PhD forester who did your PhD work at the University of Toronto.
Yes, that's right. And my undergraduate as well.
What are you currently doing in your work that is related to forests and mass timber that our listeners will be interested in hearing about?
Well, currently my work involves several different areas that are related and to varying degrees. I'm not working directly in mass timber, but I am doing a lot of work with climate change, the impacts of climate change on forests, adaptation, and carbon accounting in forests as well. For example, the forest company Mosaic on the West Coast just recently set aside about 20 to 25%, I believe, of their area as old forest to gain carbon credits, and they won't be cutting it. And I and another consultant helped them with that arrangement. I'm currently working with another company in Alberta looking at doing a forest carbon assessment for their catchment area in the northern part of Alberta. And I've also done a fair bit of work for the pellet industry as well. And there's a lot of carbon implications and interest in the carbon implications of their feedstock procurement. In terms of First Nations, I think there are a lot of opportunities for First Nations that want to become more involved in the forest sector, because many of them do, because as you know, many of them live in communities that are forest-based and surrounded by the forest, and they're looking for economic opportunities. And to date, the forest sector in Canada has been quite slow in terms of getting into the mass timber space, essentially. So there's a considerable amount of opportunity there. And the fact that mass timber also, by extracting the high quality parts of the tree from the lower quality parts of the tree, it's able to make better use of medium to low quality trees as well as high quality trees. And so there's an opportunity for better utilization of the forest resource and producing more value added than is the case in a lot of the forestry sector. So there are definitely opportunities, and I think there's a lot of interest, as I say, among indigenous communities.
An important point to make, Jeremy, because certainly the definitions of sustainability need to consider indigenous rights and participation. And certainly that is a gratifying part of forestry today.
Yes, it's very rewarding.
Yes. And we're going to talk a lot about climate change and forests as we continue this discussion. And of course, it's very inspiring for architects and engineers and foresters to think about using forests in the context of climate change mitigation. Do you have any advice to give architects and builders who want to ensure that the wood they are using is coming from a sustainable source?
Well, my main advice would be to look for wood that's produced from a certified forest. And by that, I mean a forest where the management has been evaluated by either the Forest Stewardship Council, FSC, or the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, SFI. Those are the two main certification systems that are active in Canada. And try to source wood that has been derived from forests that are certified. That's, in a way, the due diligence has been done for you by the certification bodies that do the assessments. And I guess otherwise, if you're not sure how sustainably the wood is being sourced, then you would start to do a deeper dive into what types of forests are being harvested and how it's being used and all of those sorts of things.
I know, Jeremy, you have personally audited a number of forests for certification purposes. And I wonder if you can give our listeners an idea about what that process is. What is certification, beginning with the sort of forest auditor, third party, going, visiting a forest and operations to determine whether it's meeting certification competencies?
Sure. So, Anne, if you don't mind, I'll step back a little bit and just talk about where the two certification organizations arose. Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC, was actually the first one of its kind in the world. And it developed in the very late 1990s as a result of a lot of concern that there was extensive deforestation in the tropics in particular, and that there was no indication that it was slowing down at all. And there was actually a key meeting during the process of the formation of FSC that took place in Toronto. And the result was a third-party standard, which is independent from the forest sector, it's independent from government, it's independent from the forest industry itself, because there was also a lot of distrust of all of those elements of society in terms of what they were actually doing versus what they were saying. And so the intention was to have a different take on sustainability that was broader than many of the takes that were in existence, and also have something that was independent. And so said to be influence-free. The SFI originated from the American Paper and Forest Association and was then spun out as to become an independent organization that also has its own certification standards. And their view of sustainability is broad. It includes, of course, ecological aspects, but also social and socioeconomic aspects as well. And there's a very strong legality component to it. So what the auditor does is that these systems each have standards, which are a set of indicators, which are requirements that need to be met in order for a forest to become certified. And the auditors go in and they talk to people, they talk to stakeholders, they talk to Indigenous people, they talk to government and company people, a whole variety of people that have an interest in the forest. They look at the forest management plan, what is actually being done versus what has been planned. They go out to the forest and they look at the operations and the impacts of operations directly, and they make an assessment as to the extent to which all of the elements of the standard have been met. And provided that the standard is essentially being met, the forest can become certified. And if there are major deficiencies in what is taking place on the forest versus what the standard says, then the forest manager will have to correct those before the forest can become certified. In a nutshell, that's how it works. And the auditors under both systems visit the forest every year. So they do a full assessment to start with against the entire standard, and they make annual visits, and they do partial assessments against a small part of the standard. And then 5 years after the first assessment, there's another full reassessment. So it's a constant process, and there's constant monitoring of the forest and the impacts of forest operations. So it's, it's a very intense system in many ways. And many of the companies are, it's voluntary as well, I should say. And so if a company is certified, it's because they want to be certified. And in many cases, it's because it provides them with more access to better markets. And that's especially true in the pulp and paper market. But it also helps them demonstrate that they have a commitment to sustainability and is a key part of that. And has also made their operations better because many of the criteria in the standards go above and beyond what the legal requirements are.
Jeremy, we're often asked at the Mass Timber Institute, how can we rely on certification? What, in your view, is the sort of key or critical aspect of certification that you feel warrants some confidence that what is supposed to be done is being done?
I would say one of the main qualities of the certification system is that it's very public. And so every year that there's an audit or an assessment, those reports are made available. And there are a lot of people watching because there is a lot of concern as well that the certification systems may start to deviate or become a little bit lighter in terms of their application. And so environmental groups, community groups, many people keep an eye on the reports. And if there's evidence that the auditors have missed something or have gone too easy on a company for something, complaints can be made and the audit results can be revisited.
There's a lot of global discussion around the role that forests might serve in helping us find solutions to the climate crisis. Jeremy, do you have any observations about this very big issue that would be helpful to architects and engineers in understanding the future for mass timber and sustainable forests?
That's a very big topic, Anne. So yes, there are many ways in which forests are critical to our globe's future and the future of the climate. And so beyond looking to see that the sourcing of timber is from a certified forest or from a well-managed forest, I think some of the things to bear in mind for architects also relate to sourcing. And these are some of the things that aren't necessarily well covered by the standards. Forestation is one thing that takes place for a lot of different reasons. The expansion of the agricultural industry, oil, gas, energy, those kinds of developments cause deforestation. And so there's a lot of global interest in limiting deforestation. And again, action is relatively slow in that regard. In situations where deforestation has not been caused by the procurement of that wood would be one thing that architects can look at or look for. And I guess more generally too, in terms of the impact of using mass timber as a replacement for other materials such as steel or concrete, or even whole solid beams of timber from very old forests, for example. There's a substitution effect there, which is beneficial. The production of the equivalent amount of concrete or steel emits much more in the way of greenhouse gases than the comparable emissions that come from the manufacture of mass timber. And when you do a life cycle analysis, there's definitely a greenhouse gas benefit from using mass timber versus other materials. So to the extent that architects can substitute mass timber for these other materials, there's a climate benefit.
Biogenic carbon, certainly. Measuring, locking up carbon in mass timber is a hot topic, and in some circles, highly contested. What's your take on its place in the argument for mass timber?
Well, it's part of the positive results of that you would see from using mass timber compared with other materials. A life cycle analysis would bring out that the carbon embodied in the wood that's used to produce mass timber will remain in place for a considerable period of time. In many cases, the mass timber elements are very long-lived because they're key structural pieces for buildings. They're not throwaway types of building materials. So they have long lives and they do retain timber. So what that does is when a forest is harvested, the timber that are used for mass timber then retain the carbon and keep it out of the atmosphere for as long as the mass timber is in use, which can be a very long time. And meanwhile, the forests can regrow and start sequestering carbon again. So it's positive. Yeah, mass timber is definitely one of the longer-lived forest products that can be made. So it has a potential for a very long period of storage.
When you refer to the life cycle analysis that is part of identifying biogenic carbon in wood and steel and concrete, there are more questions today, Jeremy, than there have been in the past about the harvesting of wood, about the processes that occur in harvesting the timber that will be used in mass timber fabrication or manufacturing. Have you given some thought to how harvesting practices, for example, could or should be looked at in life cycle analysis?
Well, I mean, beyond the fact that they're a part of it, I haven't really given specific thought. So I'm not really sure what you're driving at with this question. And like, are you talking about more like leaving residuals or the types of harvesting systems that are being used?
I think it's a big topic. And I think that there are questions because of the environmental construction materials require certain documents to certify where they're sourced, what their characteristics are. And I think some of these have been in place for a very long time for concrete and steel, but there's still some question with wood, and especially with the possibility of using more mass timber sourced from sustainable forests.
Yeah. Developing good supply chain tracing in forestry is proving to be pretty difficult because wood does move around a lot. And also, as the logs are broken down, the different parts of the log get moved around in different directions to a wide variety of different mills. And the sourcing, so for example, a sawmill that produces sawdust and chips and other things from wood from a whole variety of sources that could be sitting in the woodyard for a considerable period of time, those could come from a wide variety of areas. So being able to trace them back to a specific area can be very difficult. And you're right, the mechanisms aren't really there yet, but there's a lot of pressure to get those systems in place. Certainly, the biomass sector is feeling that. And you're probably aware that the European Union is putting together a requirement for no deforestation imports commodities into the EU. So this would cover wood products as well as agricultural products and others as well. And what they will be requiring is that for all of the, in the case of wood products, for the wood products that are imported into the EU, you have to be able to trace back or identify where that particular stick of timber or where that roll of pulp actually originated. And so this is something that we don't really have the capability of doing this in Canada yet to the full extent that the EU will require. But the fact that this is going to be a requirement of the EU, I think, puts a lot of pressure on Canada to get these kinds of systems in place. In other countries, I think they're further along in terms of having a very well-documented and traceable supply chain. And there are certainly gaps here in Canada.
Mm-hmm. I know that the environmental product declarations that have been in place for a long time with concrete and steel are certainly being updated for wood. And I know that the Canadian Wood Council is working hard to update these EPDs. And I guess, so to your point, it's always best to ask the producers and the manufacturers also.
Yeah. I mean, they're the ones that have the licenses and either do the harvesting themselves or more frequently have harvest contractors doing it. But there's certainly good tracking of the saw logs and other log products that are taken from forests to the mills because the provinces, I mean, most of this takes place on Crown land. And even in provinces where there's a lot of private land, such as New Brunswick, there's a requirement that all loads of logs have slips that say where they've originated from and where they're going to, and those are mandatory. So there's good tracking at that level. So certainly from the first stage producer level, there's a pretty good tracing system in place.
Jeremy, moving on, you're always reading something interesting. So I would be really keen to hear what you're reading these days that might be related to forests and mass timber and that you might like to recommend to listeners.
Sure. Well, recently I've been reading books about decision-making and human tendencies and biases and other aspects that complicate decision-making for people. So the book I'm currently reading is called Nudge. It's by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. And it's been around for a while, since 2004 or 2006, I believe. And Richard Thaler is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. And Sunstein was a senior figure in the U.S. government and implemented a lot of changes to programs to improve the uptake and the results from those programs. And what they look at are human tendencies to the human ways of thinking and analyzing situations and flaws in humans' approaches to doing that. So humans generally use heuristics or rules of thumb. They rely a lot on experience and, you know, visual stimuli. There's a lot of factors and context that's taken in subconsciously whenever we look at something that we're not even aware of. And that's used as a basis for decision-making. And in many cases, those systems work very well, but in a number of cases, they don't. And they can lead to quite substantial errors or miscalculations in terms of decision-making or behavior. And so I'm looking into that and partly with an eye to understand how regulations and how companies can be and governments can be nudged or encouraged to do better at things. There are a number of challenges to, well, throughout our society in terms of just working with different government departments, masses of regulation. Things don't happen quickly. It's often hard for people to move away from the status quo. And so I'm looking at ways of encouraging those things or being able to encourage those things more fully in my work.
You had mentioned earlier in our discussion about the importance of First Nations and Indigenous participation in forestry. What are your thoughts on what that future looks like? Things seem to have changed very positively in the last few years with respect to First Nations getting their hands on managing forests. Would you care to comment on how you see that proceeding?
Yes. There's quite a lot of variation in terms of the gains in participation on the part of First Nations in the forest sector, with, I think, the greatest gains being present in BC to paint all the provinces with a broad brush. And a lot of the reason for that is because many of the First Nations in that province never signed treaties. And so they have Aboriginal title to the land. And while that hasn't been proven for all that many First Nations in court, there have been a number of key cases, such as for the Silcateen, for example, which granted them Aboriginal title to a very large tract of land that was part of their traditional territory. And as a result of that, they essentially have, well, not exactly ownership, they have management rights and resource rights on that tract of land. And British Columbia also has basically, they've created what they call First Nations woodland licenses, where they license areas of Crown land to First Nations or First Nations organizations. And some of the licenses are quite large in the sort of 200,000 to 300,000 hectare range, which is a pretty good size. So in other parts of the country, its governments are taking a different approach and it's moving more slowly. I don't believe that Ontario is looking to bring First Nations into shared tenure arrangements more. And I think there's a lot of way to go in that regard. in that province, in this province. But I do think that there's a great deal of interest, as I said earlier, on the part of First Nations in forestry, in forests, in managing the forest differently, and also benefiting from the forest. And so, especially when so many small rural communities are depopulating across the country, and in some places, the forest sector has experienced significant reductions in capacity, especially during the 2008-2009 recession, when there were a lot of mills across the country that closed and never reopened. There are theoretically opportunities for First Nations to become more involved in the forest sector as well. So it's a question of, I think, capital, expertise, and, you know, to some extent, capacity as well, still. But many First Nations have made tremendous strides in terms of their ability to participate in the sector over the last 10 years and longer.
Good. And finally, Jeremy, what advice would you offer to our listeners about understanding how forestry ties into the use of mass timber as a building material?
Well, I guess what I would say is that I believe mass timber provides a higher value use for wood than is currently the case in many of the products that are produced. And I think what that does is it opens up the possibility for using, as I said, medium to low quality wood and logs and taking up the high quality parts, extracting value from them and making mass timber. I know that there are other operations in British Columbia, for example, which take the logs that the sawmills are below the quality specifications of the sawmills, and they cut pieces out of those and ship them to China. And so there's a similar possibility in many parts of the country with, as I say, the medium to low quality timber. Also, some of the species that aren't as highly desirable for lumber could be used for mass timber as well. So I think there's an opportunity for better utilization and extracting more value out of the timber that is harvested. And that's always very helpful, basically, to generate higher revenues from what's being produced. I think also mass timber production is more labor intensive than sawmilling, for example, or pulp and paper production. And so that also provides employment opportunities, more employment opportunities per cubic meter of wood that's used in mass timber production. And that's also beneficial as well. And of course, the higher value of the product pays for that. I think that overall, having mass timber as one of the uses of wood in conjunction with other uses of wood, I think it enables us to take the pieces out the log and put them to the best possible use given their, you know, their quality status. And I think that's a positive thing.
So another topic, we also hear from architects and engineers who are very committed to knowing more about forestry, to understanding that they can rely on foresters, very keen to understand why they can believe that forestry is a positive way to take care of a forest. I think that architects and engineers, they find it compelling when people talk about ecological forestry or restorative forestry or something that sounds like it's not traditional forestry. And in your view, are foresters doing a better or different job today than we did in the past? Or how do you see that the work we do in the forest is sort of persuasive and should be seen as really answering questions about concerns? And again, the architects and engineers we work with are very plugged into conversations going on in the environmental community. Mm-hmm. And how do we reassure them that foresters are also part of those conversations? That's a very long question.
Well, it is. So I would say that, firstly, there have been improvements in forest management. If you look, certainly 20 years ago, there was not so much interest or concern regarding species at risk, for example, and those are considered much more prominently in forest management than they used to be. I think carbon is and climate change are still in the process of finding their way into forest management in a much more meaningful way than they have been. But there are a lot of people working on that. I think the way that forests are being managed is going to change substantially. And I think in the next 10 to 15 years. And I think that two of the key drivers for that will be, well, actually, there'll be three key drivers. I think one will be Indigenous reconciliation, which we've touched on. And I think that providing First Nations with much more say and control over how forests are managed will make a big difference, actually, in how many forests are managed. I would also say that I do think that concerns over biodiversity and also over climate change are going to be really significant in forestry going forward. And I guess countervailing that, there's also what the anticipated effects of climate change will be on forests. And I'm thinking mostly in Canada here at this point in time. The expectation is for, as you know, more forest fires, more insect infestations, a lot more disturbance than what we're used to. And then further north, the permafrost will be melting, and that will disrupt a lot of those regimes as well. So there will be a lot more emphasis on identifying which forest types are more susceptible post-harvest to negative climatic influences. So, for example, like I would say, staying off peatlands, for example, would be probably one of the things that we'll see more and more of, because peat stores so much carbon in the ground, and trees aren't all that productive usually anyways, or of moderate productivity. And it just seems to me that the potential for creating a lot of emissions from operating on peatlands, especially if you're not doing it in the wintertime, outweighs the benefits that you get from the timber. So as we start to understand more about how the climate affects different types of forests and the forest in different conditions, I think we'll change our operating processes pretty substantially. And also, I think biodiversity it's a very general concept, but I think many of the trends of many bird species, for example, are very negative in many areas in Ontario anyways, and I believe in other provinces, that the moose populations are under a considerable amount of pressure, and not to mention caribou. And so I think that there's going to be much more emphasis placed on managing forests in such a way that creates better habitat and also managing the access so people are more restricted, or it's, you know, basically hunting is more restricted in these areas. So to help give them a better chance of surviving. So I think these are the kinds of things that, I mean, access, the general way in which access is treated in forestry is that once it's there, people want it there. And it's very, very difficult to decommission roads. Ontario, we do some of that. Places like British Columbia hardly do it at all. And I think that leads to a lot of problems in terms of managing wildlife. And I think, you know, we have to look more seriously at what the impacts of roads are and deal with those.
Good.
I can carry on. I mean, you know, when you consider, you know, with the carbon pricing regime in Canada, right, when you compare the value of a tree, a standing tree, like the stumpage, what Ontario gets a stumpage for one large poplar, which might be half a cubic meter of merchantable wood in it, is, you know, something on the order of a dollar. The amount of carbon in that tree is worth much more than a dollar under our current carbon pricing regime. And that pricing regime, as we all know, is forecast by the government to climb dramatically up to 2030. And carbon prices in other parts of the world are much higher than what we have here. So when you think of that, then you think, well, what is the best use of these trees, or what is the best use of this forest? And maybe it's not. Maybe a much smaller portion of the forest is best used for producing timber, and much less of it is. You know, it raises quite a question, actually.
Well, it does. And you put your finger on it. It really is, what is the value of carbon? And can we manage? Well, I think looking into the future, we would argue we can manage our forests for obtaining value, managing for carbon. And I think you mentioned earlier the example of Mosaic in British Columbia doing that. We've got examples in Ontario also with the Nature Conservancy about to do that. So then we start comparing the values of different parts of the forest resource. And you seem to be saying that carbon is becoming more and more valuable over time.
Well, it is. Keeping it out of the atmosphere is becoming more valuable. And especially as countries try to meet their commitments to Paris, I mean, there's a requirement to reduce your net emissions. And part of the way that you can do that is by avoiding emissions. And if you store carbon better, or you manage the forest in a way that it sequesters more carbon, then you're contributing towards meeting your Paris goals, which, you know, alternate ways of getting those reductions could be a lot more expensive. One of the other things that is just found out recently, which I was really interested in, was that British Columbia has had a forest fertilization program for several decades now. And so they aerially fertilize substantial areas of the forest in order to grow the timber faster. And part of the reason that they're doing that, it's under the Forest Enhancement Society of British Columbia, is climate change and increasing the sequestration of carbon by the forest, and also to offset some of the impacts from the mountain pine beetle epidemic. But I think that's really interesting. And they developed a lot of expertise in identifying what fertilizer dosages and combinations are most appropriate for what types of stands. And it's really interesting. They've gone up the learning curve, and it's interesting that they've done that. And also, I guess equally, that I don't believe any other provinces have, or nearly to the same extent.
I haven't heard of it. I mean, you and I both sort of remember decades ago the fast-growing poplar plantations that were established in eastern Ontario.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, wouldn't it be great to have those still in a state where we could understand how to grow species such as poplar faster to absorb more carbon? That experiment came to a halt, I think, through lack of government funding. But
yeah,
certainly foresters have always thought into the future about what we should be growing, how we should be growing it, what's going to be needed.
Well, that's right. You know, and another interesting implication of climate change, to me anyways, is that, yes, we have always thought into the future, 70 years, 80 years, 100 years, that sort of thing. But now, again, with climate change being an emergency, or certainly a lot of pressure being put on significant reductions to happen by, say, 2050, according to the Paris Agreement, does that mean we should focus more on the next 30 years as opposed to thinking about the next 100 years? Or, I mean, we would think about both of them equally, but maybe put more weight on the shorter term as opposed to maybe equal weight on short and the long term. You know, it makes it interesting to sort of figure out what strategically is the best approach here.
Yes, well, climate change is changing everything we do as foresters and the outside world too. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Thanks for asking me, Anne. I always enjoy talking with you.
The Mass Timber Today podcast is produced by the Mass Timber Institute at the University of Toronto's John H. Daniels Faculty of Landscape, Architecture, and Design, and explores the opportunities and challenges of mass timber with experts in the design, building, and forestry sectors to shed light on the question, what is the future of mass timber construction? You can find the show notes and any references mentioned in this podcast on our website at masstimberinstitute.ca, where you can also view our current projects and subscribe to our newsletter. This episode was edited by Derek Welsman and produced by Sean Shukla at the Mass Timber Institute. We'd also like to give a special thanks to Dialogue's Toronto Studio for their generous sponsorship of this podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the Apple iTunes ranking site. We'd also love to hear from you with any suggestions for other people you would like us to interview. You can reach us on our website.